Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our extra special guest is Corbett Barr, the founder and CEO of Fizzle, and we're going to talk about building your platform. This episode is brought to you by SaaS Growth Summit. The summit takes place February 11 and is free to attend. I'll be one of the speakers and share the stage with Rand Fishkin, Nathan Latka, April Dunford, and more. It's organized by User.com, the marketing and sales automation software for SaaS companies. Head over to saassummit.user.com to join for free. Hey, Corbett.
Hey, Jane. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be an extra special guest today.
We are so thrilled. You've been out there with Fizzle and such for like decade or two decades, like
it's
basically
been a while.
Forever. Yeah. And we're thrilled to have you here. Give us an update for those who don't know you, what you do, where you come from, and what you're up for these days.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how long I've been an entrepreneur and looking back at the timeline of the internet, right? Because the internet's not that old. When I first started in entrepreneurship, YouTube didn't exist. It launched in 2005, and I started at the beginning of 2005, end of 2004. So, you know, coming up on, I don't know, 16, 17 years, something like that, I have been earning a living independently from blogging, podcasting, creating SaaS, creating memberships, creating online courses, all that sort of stuff. The bulk of that over the past 7 or 8 years has been, as you mentioned, Fizzle, which is really a community training library and coaching for small independent entrepreneurs. We have served over 26,000 people there over the past 8 years and have really just had a good time watching people with an idea around something they're interested in and then turning that into an audience and eventually building products and selling those to people. It's really kind of the dream of what people are calling the creator economy right now. And we're seeing all of that sort of gather momentum and energy recently. So it's really fun.
I wonder, with Fizzle, you go after entrepreneurs in general. Did you find yourself expanding your target audience or vice versa? Did you start out wider and then, you know, niching down on a certain type of an internet business per se?
Well, I would say that the technology and the mediums have changed a little bit over the years. When we started, I would say that blogging was the primary interest that people had. They had, you know, wanted to start a blog, write about a topic, grow an audience, and so on. But podcasting has become very popular over the past, you know, 6 years or so. And being a YouTuber has become popular as well, reaching people on social media. There are a lot of different channels that people use. So with Fizzle, we expanded over time to include courses on all kinds of different ways that people can build an audience and really have come to focus on what we call independent entrepreneurs, small people who aren't looking to raise venture capital necessarily. They're not looking necessarily to build a big team. They just want to earn a living doing something that they care about online, using the internet as a way to reach.
Today, we're going to talk about building your digital platform. And actually, one of the triggers why I decided to reach out to you and invite to the show is because you started sending out those exciting updates about, you know, yourself starting over your own digital presence from scratch. So give us an update on that.
Yeah, I decided, well, to be honest, I was on the phone with an entrepreneurial friend of mine. We were catching up about what we each had going on. And I commented to her, I said, you know, I feel like I've got a lot of things going on and I'm pulled in a lot of different directions and it's really hard to make a decision and to make progress on anything because I've got all these different projects going on. And she said, you know, I think that you've said that same thing for a couple of years now. And it really just hit me that I had kind of become stuck and I had you know, friends now telling me that I had been saying the same thing for a couple of years and not really making progress or taking action on it, almost like I was complaining but not doing anything about it. So that made me, that kind of lit a fire under me and made me decide that even if I didn't have all the answers, I wanted to start the ball rolling and to announce publicly that I was making some big changes. So I revived my email list, my personal email list, which I hadn't reached out to in a very long time, and decided to tell everyone that I was starting over in a way. And what I did was I deleted all of my social media posts across every platform that I had. I removed the majority of the content on my personal blog, as well as other blogs that I had out there. I deleted old other accounts on various platforms, really just wanted to wipe the slate clean so that I could clear my head and make room for the next chapter, whatever that is. I have, you know, several projects that people ask me about that are still ongoing, like Fizzle, for example, is intact, and it's a very vibrant community, and you know, frankly, it earns revenue as well, and I don't want to necessarily make any rash decisions there. But around the edges of all that, because I've been operating online for, as you know, we just talked about, for the better part of a decade and a half, there you end up accumulating what I would consider to be digital baggage. All of these things that we publish, podcasts, videos, blog posts, social media, and then little projects that we've started here and there, you just kind of end up leaving this wake of litter in your path that isn't necessarily serving you now and isn't necessarily going to be helpful to you if you want to make any dramatic changes going forward. So I announced publicly that I was wiping the slate clean, partly so that it would force me to take action, and then also so that I would be able to start having these interesting conversations with other people about what it means to have a digital self. Whether we like it or not, we all have this other person that exists out there who isn't exactly us. It's a reflection of us and what we want to do, and often has very commercial intent. We don't necessarily exist online just for our own pleasure. A lot of us exist online because it's our bread and butter. It's where we earn a living. So we have these digital selves, and I'm really interested in what it means to construct and maintain these digital selves over time, now that the internet is all grown up and has been around, you know, for most people for the better part of a couple of decades.
This is all really fascinating. And, you know, I think it's been a trend for a while, you know, to think about your digital presence and such. But apart from social media and this, you know, Netflix documentary angle that everybody is talking about these days, apart from that, let's talk about the professional digital profile, your platform, something that can help you as a creator, as a business person. So you have quite a privilege to start from scratch, but revive an amazing email list that you have. So not everybody who is listening to us has one. If you were to truly start from scratch these days, how would you even think about building your profile online as a professional?
Yeah, it's a really great question, especially because, you know, right now, as we're recording this, we've seen that the major platforms have decided to remove the sitting president, the former sitting president of the United States, from their platforms. And it's made a lot of people think about censorship and free speech and all kinds of things. It also, I think, for me, has brought to light a lot of the problems that exist in social media. You know, social media platforms can be an incredible way to reach an audience. And as a creator, we would be crazy not to at least consider them as a way to potentially reach an audience. But at the same time, those platforms don't exist just for our benefit. They exist for the benefit of the massive wealthy companies behind them that have created them. And as they created those platforms, we're talking about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of the major platforms. And now, you know, you can consider YouTube and Twitch and these other places are also forms of social media. They created those in a way to be as immersive, as demanding, as persuasive as possible. They're really persuasive technologies, meaning that they have engineered them using everything possible to convince us to keep coming back. You know, the fact that they invented like that you can tag a friend in a photo, that is an impossible thing for us to ignore, right? If you get an email or a notification on your phone that says a friend tagged you in a photo, it's impossible for you to ignore that. You have to go and check that out. And so that's almost in a way like a dirty trick that they use to keep us coming back to these platforms, because the more frequently we visit, the more time that we spend there, the more they're able to sell us ads. So as a creator, as someone who is trying to build their own audience, we really have to think about the goals that those platforms have for themselves and to look at them as a tool and not necessarily as the end game in itself. So I always encourage people, you know, you mentioned email, to think about the difference between platforms and protocols. Platforms are places that companies build where people spend time. And usually those are walled gardens in a way. Like for Facebook, for example, if someone puts up information on Facebook, or Medium even as a channel for writing a blog, if someone puts up content on that, in order for someone else to read it, they often have to have an account. They have to log in. They have to become part of that garden, that walled garden, in order to participate there. And that means that if Medium or Facebook or Twitter or whatever decide to change the rules on how the algorithms work, you may not have as much reach as you've thought. You don't really own that connection that you have to your audience on those platforms. Whereas with a protocol is something that is open. It's not controlled by one individual company. Email is an ancient protocol. It's been around for 40 something years now on the internet. Other examples of protocols would be RSS. That's also a protocol where if I have your RSS feed, I can connect directly to it, to your actual server, and I don't have to go through some platform to get there. Podcasting is another example of a protocol where I have your podcast feed and I can connect directly to that information without having to go through some sort of third party. So anywhere that we can reach people through a protocol, that means we actually own that connection to the audience and that no one can get between me and that audience. And that's a very important thing as you're growing your business. It's much more valuable to have a connection directly to an audience member than it is to have a connection to an audience member via Facebook or Twitter or something like that. I'm not saying necessarily that you shouldn't use Facebook or Twitter. We all have opportunities to grow a tremendous audience there. But just if you're building a business, to keep in mind the differences there and to try to work to build something that has more value, a more direct connection over time.
It's great that we touched on why you shouldn't be using, well, what the dangers are of trusting your relationship. And we can talk about that a little bit more. But why is it so lucrative to, you know, trust all your business to Instagram, for example? Why is it that people have the entire stores, the entire professional lives in there? I find it super scary, but they probably are fine. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, they probably are fine. Although I think if you've been around for a while, you've heard stories. I have a friend, for example, who built the majority of his business on the Amazon affiliate program. And last year, Amazon decided to cut the revenue share in half. So overnight, his revenue dropped by half. And that's a serious blow. So it's sort of like, you know, if you can think of it almost as the advice that you get if you're in the financial markets, if you're investing in stocks and so on, to diversify. That's the key to having stability over the long haul, to diversify and to not put all of your eggs in one basket or not put all of your eggs in one platform, so to speak. If I had built, for example, my entire following on Twitter and then let it go stale over the course of, you know, several years, you might find that the people who are active on Twitter are quite different now than they were 5 or 10 years ago. And I've found this personally because I've gotten more active on Twitter recently. And I found that nominally I have a decent number of followers, a lot of those are just dormant accounts. And so I don't necessarily have the reach that I would want to, versus, having an email list. I dusted that off. And of course, some people were like, wow, I'm surprised to hear from you. It's been a while. those are still real people and you can still reach them because everyone still uses their inbox, but not everybody continues to use a platform like Instagram or Twitter or something like that over time. So it's, I'm not saying that it's the key to running a successful business. It's just something to think about. And at the same time, it's also important to me as a creator to think about the way that we're using these platforms and what they demand of us and how we're spending our time. I think we've sometimes heard the advice to be everywhere, you know, that we should be on all the platforms. You see successful people like Gary Vaynerchuk, for example, being active on every single social media platform out there. He has a team of people. He's also an extraordinarily energetic person. As I have gotten to know a lot of individual creators, I know that most people have trouble keeping up one platform. They have trouble keeping up one channel. So the way that we use these platforms, I think, really dictates how much time we have to spend on truly building our business. And sometimes we can, because it feels like the right thing to do, open up accounts on all of these different places and then come to find out that it's not necessarily the most beneficial thing to us in terms of building a business.
I cannot agree more with the part that says limited resources. Mm-hmm. I know there are people probably, you know, fueled by whatever kind of fuel. I don't know. Justin Jackson is one of the people who runs like dozens of communities all on his own, very excited to engage with anyone. Well, I'm really like light years away from that kind of person. And seriously, running a community is actually super hard task for me. So I would refrain from doing that unless, I don't know, it's super critical to the business. So if we are one of those people who have limited time or limited energy, what are the channels that we can consider using? Protocols, maybe? For example, one principle that I'm aware of is that you should be enjoying the medium you employ. For example, I do enjoy podcasting. I hate video. Therefore, I'm not on YouTube, but I'm running a show. Also, podcasting is much easier for me than writing, but that's not for everybody. What is your recommendation how to choose the proper medium?
Yeah, and I'm the same way. I really enjoy audio, and video I find a lot more challenging. And I think, you know, most people find video more challenging because it just, it requires so much energy, personality, charisma, and so on to show up fully on camera. And then also, it just brings a lot of emotional baggage in a way. Being on camera feels like such a judgment of you and who you are sometimes. So I find YouTube difficult as well. And, you know, the mistake that I see some people make as individual creators or as someone building a SaaS looking for a channel to promote themselves, to promote their business, is sometimes they just consider it almost in the abstract. They think about where are the people that I want to reach and which channel has the best properties for me. But they don't necessarily think about which one am I most suited for, meaning which one do I enjoy? Which one am I going to be able to show up weekly or, you know, at least several times a month? Because to really grow an audience, you have to get in this amazing habit of creating content on a regular basis. And it is a tremendous challenge. I've seen, you know, so many people start out with the greatest of intentions. And, you know, it's fun to think about producing a YouTube channel, or it's fun to think about starting a podcast. And then you get into the weekly effort of actually producing that thing. And you find out that it's a lot of work to show up, to schedule the guests, to edit the show, to come up with ideas and so on. And so if you start out by choosing a channel that you are not well suited for, then you have all kinds of barriers that you have to get over, in addition to just needing to show up and create the content. If it's also a chore because it's not the right kind of medium for you, it can just be a losing game from the beginning. So I think you want to give yourself every advantage possible. And that means whatever medium, whatever format, whatever kinds of customers that you enjoy interacting with. That's another thing that people don't necessarily think about when they start a business. Are these, you know, are the people that are going to be my customers the kinds of people that I enjoy talking to and that I actually care about and that I want to reach? If you get all of those things right, then it just makes it a lot easier to grow an audience and to find customers.
Let's talk about building an email list. And I know for people who have been out there for a while with their businesses, they have had an opportunity to appreciate that as a stable, you know, foundation for any business. But for those who are starting out, why having an email list is so important, why you should be starting to grow it as early as possible, and why email and not something else?
Yeah. So email, and I know it, maybe it, to some people, it sounds old or cliche or something, but the truth is that email still has tremendous value as a tool for reaching people. And that's because email is still a bit of a sacred place for people. Most of us check email several times a day. Even though we've got all kinds of amazing new communication platforms, email is still the common thread. You pretty much need an email to open accounts on most platforms. And, you know, it's where your bank and everyone else sends you important details, right? So email is a sacred channel. It is also a channel that you get to push to as someone that has a connection to someone else. Instead of, you know, if you post something on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you become one of hundreds of messages that might fly by in somebody's newsfeed, you know, throughout the day. And they're just very kind of fleeting, ephemeral sort of messages. Whereas with email, a lot of times the way that people process their inboxes, they have to deal with each message in that inbox. They have to take some action on it. If you're someone like me, you tend to either archive or respond to every single message in your inbox. So it's a sacred place. It still gets more engagement than other platforms, and you get to push messages there to someone whenever you want. So it's highly effective. Growing an email list is a challenge, but growing a list anywhere, growing a following on any platform is a challenge. Growing an email list is simply a matter of the number of visitors that you get to your website and the conversion rate that you have on those visitors in turning them into email subscribers. So if you want to grow a list, a friend, James Clear, just celebrated adding his 1 millionth email subscriber to his list, which is massive. There are very few companies that have a list that big, let alone an individual person with an email list of a million people. But James was just really smart about growing his email list. He recognized that it, again, is simply a factor of how many people are visiting my site every month and what portion of those can I turn into email subscribers. So to grow a list of a million people, you just have to have millions of people visiting your website, and you have to convert a high percentage of them. Maybe, you know, he might convert 5% or something of everyone that visits his website into an email subscriber. So if you have been trying to grow an email list and it's not going well, you're just getting a trickle of people, you just simply have to look at those two numbers. How many people do I have coming every day? And, you know, if you only have 10 or 20 or 50 people coming every day and you're only converting 1% of those, then you probably aren't adding people to your list every day. It might take several days to get someone to sign up. On the other hand, if you have, let's say, 1,000 people coming every day and you're converting 5%, then you would have 50 people signing up for your list every day. And over time, that really adds up. So it's there's not a lot of mystery to how to do it. It's just a matter of the habit of creating content that attracts people and focusing on making sure that you're converting those people in a really smart and compelling way.
What are the trends when it comes to lead magnets these days? It feels like this art of lead magnets has sort of exhausted itself over time, but I'm sure there are trusted ways that still work, especially with the audience that are less, you know, marketing savvy, that don't sniff marketing from when they see something. So what works with people from your community, for example?
Yeah. And it really, I'm glad that you brought it up in terms of what works with people that are into marketing versus people that are not into marketing. It really depends on which segment, which niche of people you're trying to reach. In certain circles, the lead magnet, when you say lead magnet, you know, really you're talking about something that you're offering in exchange for people to sign up for your email list. A lot of times that might be in the old days, just a PDF of some sort. Some places offer like a lot of different PDFs. You'll see that there are, you know, are 10 different guides or something that you could sign up for. Some places offer a webinar in exchange for your email. Maybe you attend a live training of some sort. You might be signing up for an email series that is teaching you something. You could be getting a free online course. There are all kinds of different things. I was talking with a friend of mine recently who runs designcuts.com. His name's Tom Ross. And something that he sees work really well in the design related space is offering a bundle of resources. So instead of just one thing that you're downloading, you might be opting in to get a page of like 50 different resources, and that can work well. But what you have to do is, in your particular niche, you have to look around at the competition, see what appears to be working for people, and you might have to try several things to find out what's working for you as well. And it's not just about the format. It's also about the topic or the content itself. So someone might declare that, oh, PDFs don't work. I tried a PDF and nobody wanted to sign up for it. But for someone else, a PDF download might work really well. And that's because the topic or the actual content of that PDF was incredibly valuable. So it really depends on who you're reaching, the format you're using, and the content itself. And again, you know, by looking around at the competition, you can kind of find out what might be working better for some than others. And then, of course, there are all the places that you actually refer to that download on your own website. There are a lot of different places that you can post signup forms, and, you know, there's slideovers and pop-ups and all these kind of things. And in some niches, people have become a bit blind to those things because we see them so often. But in other spaces, they might be working a lot better.
As an owner of an email list, I'd like to ask a specific question about what do you do with an email list that's fairly old and you have a feeling that the engagement is really dropping because some of the context just go stale or dormant. So as owners of lists, should we trim them and like in half or even more? It's also a vanity number. So what do you do? Because James Clear wouldn't cut down his million subscribers even if half of them were dormant, right? Because it's a vanity number for him.
It is a vanity number. Although in James's case, I don't know what the current stats are, but I saw at some point that he had an overall open rate of like 40%, which is really, really good. Usually you have to have a fairly small, fresh, new list in order to get open rates that are, you know, up close to 50%. But James's list is, you know, going on several years old and it's massive and he's still getting 40% of people to open, which is just absolutely incredible. For others, I think that it is a vanity number. It feels great to say that I've grown a list to 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people, whatever your big goal is. And then to cut that by trimming it, you know, can feel like a real blow. And you maybe don't feel quite as good about yourself and what you're doing. But vanity numbers are just that. They make you feel better, but they don't necessarily actually improve your business. And having people on your list who aren't opening, aren't clicking, aren't reading, really isn't serving you in any other way than costing you money every month, because most of us are paying for our email list based on the number of subscribers on that list. And in some cases, you know, once you grow a list to 50 or 100,000 people, it ends up costing you hundreds of dollars a month, right? If you use a standard service like ConvertKit, you might be paying $500 or $1,000 a month or something. So trimming your list is a matter of identifying people that have been dormant, that aren't opening, aren't clicking, that sort of thing, and engaging them through a campaign to try to re-engage them, to get them to actually open or something. And I've seen this done in a number of ways, but you can actually send basically a new autoresponder to people that you identify as being dormant. And over time, you send them a message saying, hey, are you still listening? If so, please click here telling me that you still want to be a part of this list. You're trying to get them to do something that you can actually measure so that they move from that dormant segment back into the active population. The trouble with trimming your list, of course, is that some of these measures can be unreliable. And this is something that you probably know a lot more about, having, you know, run a SaaS business that actually engages in some of these things. But open rates for email lists, for example, are unreliable because in order to know if someone actually opens an email, you have to use some little tricks inside of the email. And sometimes those tricks are blocked depending on what channel they're using to read your email. So that's why you want to go an extra step to try to get someone to actually click on something that is a little bit more easily measured by your email tool. But it can also feel good once you actually do trim your list to see your open rates go up. You know, if you've got an old stale list of people who are no longer interested in your thing or not reading anymore, or maybe they've been filtering your emails to go not even to their inbox anymore, and you see your open rates slide down below 20%, down to 15%, 10%, something like that. And suddenly, if you trim all of those old people and now you see your open rates back up, then at least you know you have an active, engaged audience. And it can feel good to know that at least the people who are on your list are paying attention.
Let's go back to your own digital transformation. How are you treating your own personal list as of today? So are you planning to build it using all the potential weaponry that you're aware of? Or is it like a very personal thing that you're just confiding in? Or what is it for you?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely paying attention to the email list. And I have, over the years, had grown a fairly large email list from blogging, podcasting, and other things that I've done through my own personal platform. So I've been paying attention to it. I definitely intend to grow the list. Right now, I'm not employing any sort of lead magnets or opt-ins. I'm simply trying to encourage people to sign up to follow along and to pay attention to what I have to say on various topics, and also to kind of keep up to date on this digital reboot that I'm doing. I'm watching the conversion rate closely, and I have experimented with a couple of things, and I intend to experiment in the future. And basically, the way that I look at this is, you know, I make an offer for people to sign up and I watch what the conversion rate is from the traffic that I get every day. And then I might try something, you know, next week. I might try some sort of opt-in or some other sort of offer and see if I get a better conversion rate. I could, of course, go a step further and do actual A/B testing, but because this is my personal project, I'm a little bit more casual about it. So I'm just really feeling with my gut what I think people want and kind of watching the conversion rate from week to week as opposed to testing something with A/B tools.
You're definitely sending out updates, but it does not feel like you're specifically, you know, writing articles or publishing your personal essays or anything like that. Are you planning to? Are you planning to grow in that direction?
Yeah, I have been writing maybe once or twice a month over the past several months and emailing people when I feel like an article is really useful to them. The thing is, over the years, there's this concept of finding your voice. And all of us go through this in the beginning, where we're trying to figure out who we are, who are we, what do we have to say to the world, how are we useful to other people. And finding your voice, I think, can feel like a one-time thing, an event. Once you've done it, then you know who you are and you move on. But over time, I found that finding your voice is actually an ongoing effort. And it's easy to start to become defined by the things that you've said in the past. And so this process of clearing house is a way for me to be able to reassert my voice and also to identify things that I might want to be known for or to be part of a conversation going forward for the next chapter, the next 10 years. So the way that I'm using my own personal blog right now is I'm writing about things that I'm interested in, that I think other people would be interested in, that I think they would find useful to hear from me about. And then I'm putting those out there and judging the response being how people are talking about it on social media, what sort of replies I'm getting to emails, and then also through, you know, having conversations with people on podcasts like this. So I'm really using it as a tool to refine my voice and to figure out exactly who I want to be, what my digital self needs to be going forward.
And how is that going? What do you have a theme or a few options of how you imagine your, you know, hot topics being the next few years?
Yeah, well, the three things that I'm interested right now are first of all, the creator economy. And that's really, to me, the definition of that is just the overall trends that are happening in individual people being able to earn a living on the internet by reaching an audience and creating things for them directly. So the creator economy is one thing. The next thing that I'm really interested in is digital mindfulness. And that is just encouraging people and encouraging myself to use technology and to use digital platforms in a more mindful way so that we're getting the maximum benefit from it without encouraging or incurring all of the risks that exist in those platforms and without spending an inordinate amount of time. Because, you know, at the end of the day, life is not experienced just through a screen. There's life going on all around us. And it's good to remember that there are other things that are important to us as well. And then the third thing that I'm interested in is what I'm calling technology for social good. And what I mean by that is, for example, when we talked earlier about platforms as opposed to protocols, I think there are far too many profit-centric platforms out there right now and not enough open protocols. And I look forward to a world in which social protocols are more open and that fewer of the key things that we do online are controlled by massive, you know, uber wealthy corporations like Google, Facebook, and so on. I would love to see that more decentralized, more in the hands of the people, and built in a way that is meant to serve the public in the greatest way possible, as opposed to just serving a handful of really wealthy people.
I think there was an attempt some time ago, quite a few years ago, but I totally forgot the name of the initiative, something.net, I don't know, app.net or something that was supposed to combine all digital presence in one like sign-on system or something like that. Did it go anywhere? Are you aware of it?
There are a number of attempts to decentralize social media. In some cases, people are trying to do sort of a peer-to-peer social network. There's a new protocol actually that just came out recently that is a replacement for HTTP. So when you access content online, you're actually accessing it in a peer-to-peer way, almost like we used to download like BitTorrents and things like that. So there are all sorts of interesting projects happening. The issue is that the big social platforms have such tremendous power right now. Facebook has billions of people on its platform. It's going to be a major challenge for any of these platforms to take off. And as a creator, it can be fun, of course, to spend time on these platforms, but I have to judge where I'm spending my time and where the people that I want to reach are. So there's going to have to be some sort of a critical mass that happens on any of these decentralized efforts in order to pull enough people to them. These things can happen quickly. I mean, we've seen recently that a lot of people are leaving the WhatsApp platform in favor of Signal and Telegram just because this has become a privacy concern and enough people have been talking about it. So these things can happen quickly, but I don't think that there's anything identified just yet that is going to decentralize those platforms. So I look forward to it in the future and I'm really excited to follow it and see where it goes, but I don't think we're there yet.
That situation with big companies affecting politics, as in disabling the accounts of the president, which was pretty revolutionary. Now, there's another angle to that. We have recently been discussing our infrastructure at Useless with my co-founder, Benedict. And, you know, the options are Heroku, but all web apps run on that. And then the alternative is Amazon Web Services, and Heroku also runs on AWS. And it's pretty scary to understand that the whole internet runs on AWS, which belongs to Amazon. If you think about it, like the powers of Instagram are even less scary if you compare compare that to the fact that the whole internet works on Amazon, not even the social platform. What do you think of that? How do you sleep?
And I, you know, I've had to make similar choices. I mean, we run servers that at the end of the day are on Google's cloud. I've chosen AWS for certain projects myself. And it's tough to find alternatives. There are really just, I mean, in the cloud space, it's AWS Microsoft and Google are the big players. And we've also seen where that can be an issue, especially when there's a DNS outage or something. You can see that a bunch of big websites around the world go down all at once because they all run on AWS or some other platform. So, you know, there are massive economies of scale, and we all get to enjoy the cost benefits of being on AWS and having most of our services run on it. But at the same time, it ends up being somewhat frail. And then we also see that Amazon is taking over the world. I mean, they're absorbing everything from mom and pop stores to all of the different hosting providers, and really have their hands in a lot of different places. And then, of course, Jeff Bezos becomes the richest person in the world, worth $200 billion. And there are a lot of moral and philosophical questions about it, as well as just what's good for the internet and what's good for humanity with having so many things concentrated in one place. I'm always a fan of seeing competition in the marketplace and seeing small businesses like yourself and others that are operating in a niche that's serving customers in a really interesting way. And when one company becomes so big, they have so much power and so much money that they can decide to squish little companies, you know, at will, basically by operating for free in their space or competing with them in ways that end up being unfair. So there are a lot of things to think about. I think at the government level, we're going to see a lot of concern about deregulation. And I think also from the consumer standpoint, hopefully we'll see a little bit of pushback against these big companies when we realize how powerful they are, and that by default, we've given them the choices over who to silence, who to censor, and that those aren't necessarily the people that we want to be in charge of those decisions.
Are there any resources out there that you can recommend for reading, watching on the topic, for both on the topics of privacy and those concerns, as well as actually, you know, being more mindful about your marketing as a person or as a company?
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting sources. I'll give you a couple. One that works really well always is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, EFF.org. This is an organization that's been around for 30-something years, and they are always at the forefront of thinking about censorship, privacy, and really just freedom online. So they're always looking out for all of these important issues, and they run a blog and write really great articles. So check that out at EFF.org. Another one that's interesting that's more recent is a newsletter, a Substack newsletter by Casey Newton called Platformer. And this is really what he calls news at the intersection of Silicon Valley and democracy. So thinking about how politics are playing into technology. That is one that I've been reading quite a bit. And then finally, Kara Swisher, who writes for the New York Times as well as other places. She's another one that always kind of has her finger on the pulse of what's going on in technology and how it relates to society as a whole.
I'm sorry we never mentioned the paid newsletters, but we should absolutely dedicate a couple minutes to that trend. So what do you think of this? Is it promising, or is it going to trickle out eventually?
Well, I love it. I'm encouraged by it. I love any time that one individual person is able to support another individual person through a direct payment for the things that they do. And I mention that as a distinction from an advertising-based model. For example, you know, when someone becomes popular on YouTube or Twitch, they end up being paid indirectly from the advertisers that are supporting those platforms. So I love the direct model. I also love the direct model when it is when someone is paying for something specific as opposed to a Patreon sort of model. In the Patreon model, you just decide to say pay $5 a month to someone, and they may or may not be creating something, but a lot of times it's just sort of a general payment because you like that person and you're supporting their work. I prefer the payment that is more direct for a specific deliverable, like a newsletter or an online course, or, you know, personally, I've run a membership where people pay monthly to get access to a video training library. So I love that direct model. In terms of newsletters themselves, I think it's clearly a bit of a fad right now, and people are really excited about subscribing to newsletters. I don't know how big that overall market can be and how many newsletters we all can subscribe to and actually read every day or every week or every month. So, you know, that'll settle in at some point. I don't know that we've necessarily reached peak newsletter. There's probably room for it to grow. But also, it's interesting to kind of watch which companies are supporting these newsletters. Right now, the default is Substack. Substack is a Silicon Valley-based company that has raised venture capital, and they are currently charging what I feel like is a fairly exorbitant amount to these newsletter providers. It ends up being something on the order of like 13% of revenues. Other companies have gotten into the game, like ConvertKit recently launched paid newsletters, and they end up being a lot less expensive. The question, of course, is where do you find your newsletter subscribers, and how much promotion are you getting by participating on something like Substack versus another platform like ConvertKit, or even rolling your own? Some people actually just build their own infrastructure to deliver a paid newsletter, which is kind of a fun technology exercise. So there's going to be a lot of developments there. I think 2021 has a lot in store for paid newsletters, and it's definitely one of the trends that I'm paying attention to for creators.
Another trend that's definitely emerging is paid podcasts. And I've thought a ton about that because managing sponsorships, it's hard. It's another like deal to creating a show, but also podcasting feels like it's a free medium by nature. What is your personal sentiment about charging for, like, you know, every fourth episode or something goes only to paid subscribers? I feel this is somewhat odd, but there are so many platforms that come up for these premium podcast sponsorships. I can't say it's all bad. So what do you think?
Yeah, and just thinking about my own usage of media, of podcasts and newsletters and blogs and so on, there are certain sources that I'm happy to pay for. There are certain creators that I really get a lot from, and I would be happy to support with payments. In fact, our work at Fizzle, you know, we have published a podcast for, I don't know, like 6 or 7 years, almost 400 episodes. And we had a lot of people who would sign up for our monthly membership just as a way to say thank you for the podcast and the value that they got from the podcast, even though they weren't necessarily planning to participate in the membership that we offered. So I think there are plenty of cases where you can expect that your audience, a certain portion of your audience, will be willing to pay for what you offer. I think you can also make the case that blogging and podcasting and others feel like free mediums, and a lot of people have become accustomed to getting those things for free. And so in some cases, it can be difficult to compete. Now, the challenge for anyone who charges for a newsletter or a podcast or anything else or blog content is that you still need to grow your audience in order to have enough people that you can actually charge. So you'll have to decide, if, for example, if your podcast is paid, do you have a version of it that's free? Do you, like you said, just publish every fourth episode as a paid podcast? There are different models. And for paid newsletter people, there are different models as well. And, or do you grow your audience for a period of time so that it gets big enough so that then you can market the paid podcast? I think there are things to consider there. And if you're going to go down that route, you have to be very considerate about where your marketing is coming from and where your revenue is coming from, and which is which, and how you're going to balance the two of those, and pay attention to, you know, some of the sources that we just mentioned, talking about people that are following these trends will have interesting things to say about it. But you also just need to scope out the competition and find out who's doing these things well. In some cases, you know, there are platforms out there that help you, like Substack, and on the paid podcasting front, there are some platforms that can help you do that as well. You can look to them for best practices as well, because in order for them to grow their business, they have to have some of these issues ironed out. And in a lot of cases, they'll be talking about those also.
Well, Corbett, thanks so much for sharing all your wisdom today. We spent a great deal of time, and I hope this is valuable to our listeners who want to put out their word online meaningfully. And that is great food for thought. Where can people find your new identity online so that they can join your mailing list?
Yeah, absolutely. My new old identity they can find over at CorbettBarr.com. It's my personal blog. You'll find thoughts on, as I said, the creator economy, digital mindfulness, tech for social good, and you'll be able to follow along and find out what I'm doing with this whole digital reboot, because it's still a work in progress and there's still a lot more work to do. When you decide to reboot your digital self, it's not as if there's one button that you can push and wipe the entire slate clean. There are a lot of different corners of the internet that you have to go to remove things. And then also some of that stuff requires a lot of thought and consideration as to whether or not you want to remove something or maybe use it in a different format. So instead of a one-time event, a digital reboot to me is more of an ongoing process, and I'm really in the middle of it right now.
Awesome. Well, congrats on making such a bold move, and thank you for sharing your journey.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jane.